So I'm going to start with a song that I'm not going to sing. boo. But, you know, if you'd like to try afterwards, that's fine. And it's a song from one of the early Buddhist nuns, the early Buddhist followers of the Buddha. And this is what she says. She says, "The whole world is burning. The whole world is in flames. The whole world is blazing. The whole world shakes. But the Buddha taught me the unshakable way. Ordinary people don't practice it, and there is nothing to which you can compare it. When I heard his words, I lived in the joy of the teaching. The three knowledges have been realized. The Buddha's teaching has been done. The great dark is torn apart." So in that song of this early follower of the Buddha, she has two visions. The first vision is a vision of the world in flames. And I know the theme of this weekend is metta blazing like the sun, but these are not the flames of metta. These are the flames of greed and hatred. And in this world on fire, this shaking, trembling world, nothing stays still. Everything is on fire. Everything is in a process of transformation. And into that vision comes something unshakable, something solid to hold on to, the Dharma, the truth itself, the teaching of the Buddha. And she says she lives in deep joy and happiness. There's something that makes sense in all of this confusion. And she also has another image, a vision of darkness, a vision of the darkness of ignorance. And into that darkness, into that great darkness, comes a tear, like a veil being torn apart, letting in the light. And I was trying to sort of get myself in the mood for this talk, and one of the things that kind of came to mind was a film that I watched as a child. So I know this is a young people's event, but actually I was thinking of the 1946 version of the film of Great Expectations, which, if you haven't seen it, is absolutely fantastic. It's just, in a way, the whole thing is just incredibly symbolic, very, very vivid imagery. And at the end of that film, I don't know if you know the story of Great Expectations or not. It was written quite a long time ago. But anyway, in that film, in the last scene, there's this great big house, mostly empty house, Miss Havisham's house, and it's completely covered in cobwebs, and it's dark and it's dusty. And everything's been there for years and years and years, and there's these kind of mice running around and old food just decaying. You can almost smell it, even though it's a film. And into this house comes Pip, this young man full of bright hope. And he goes in, and there's a young woman who's sort of trapped in there. She's sort of trapped in her own kind of confusion and depression. And he comes in and he says, "This is a dead house. This is a dead house. Nothing can live here. It's nothing but dust and decay." And then he runs around the building and he just tears down all the curtains and throws open the shutters, and all this dust kind of piles up. And it's such a beautiful image, because into this darkness, into this kind of decay and sort of stagnant air, comes light and energy and hope. Comes this kind of freshness of Pip letting in the light. Okay, so in all that image, well, why am I starting here? Why am I starting here for a talk about metta, talking about darkness and flames of greed, hatred and delusion? Well, in a way, it's slightly personal to me, because in my life recently, I've been having quite a difficult time, and particularly in meditation. So I don't know if anyone else has had this experience, but I've been meditating for quite a long time now, about 18 years. And I've kind of come to this, sort of mood in meditation where it was completely stuck. It was a bit like being in Miss Havisham's house. It was like someone completely sucked out the air and the light in my consciousness. So, you know, here am I, living at Tirunalloka, talking quite a lot about metta. I think I've racked up a lot of talks about metta. I've done it for many years, you know. So I kind of think I know what I'm doing. And, you know, here am I handing out wise advice to other people, talking about the Dharma and how to practice the metta bhavana. And then I go into my own meditation and it's like this total wasteland. And I just think, geez, where am I? And then I think, oh, I've been here before. I've been here before in childhood and adolescence. And I thought, great. So I've reached my 30s and I've still got the mental state of that I did when I was an adolescent. Fantastic. And then I was thinking, oh, I've got to give a talk on metta. And it's like, you know, every time I sit down, my consciousness is just dark, dark wasteland. But actually, you know, I'm not as I was when I was a teenager, thank goodness. The good thing about practicing for a long time is that when that kind of thing happens, I don't necessarily see it as a problem. So I didn't see it particularly as a problem. Well, it's sort of still there, but not quite in the same way. But anyway, what I do is I see this period as an invitation. It's an invitation to go deeper. And in a way to, yeah, forget everything I've ever learned about metta. Forget all those talks that I've given about metta. Forget all that really helpful advice that I'm suddenly really embarrassed about giving, you know. In a way, embrace that. Enter the wasteland of kind of discarded opinions and old ways of doing things. And find my way through using a different capacity. Trying to understand things at a deeper level. And I think that's the invitation at times like that, is go deeper. Discard old opinions, discard old habits, discard any notion that you had that you knew what you were talking about, and go deeper. And don't rely on your old capacities. I think a lot of my life I've also relied on a particular kind of confidence. I think also being an order member quite young, and possibly being a woman comes into this as well. You know, I've always felt a little bit like I had to fight to make my case. You know, I've had to kind of stand up and say, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to not do it just because I'm young and a bit embarrassed or shy. I was actually very, very shy when I was at school. But I didn't want to sort of just settle in that. I really wanted to kind of make myself heard. And a lot of that took a particular kind of confidence, which actually I don't really want to rely on anymore. Kind of also a sort of arrogance that I knew better than other people and that I was right. And I think in a way, you know, you can't rely on that forever. It's quite good for a while, but sometimes you just got to go deeper and look deeper in your own experience. And of course, it's that time of the year as well. I was thinking about this time of the year where it's the time of year to descend, to go into that kind of darkness, to go into one's own experience and really reflect. So that's what I decided to do. I decided to really reflect, well, what is this? And in a way, what is metta? And that's particular to my own experience at the moment and a particular time in my life and my practice. But I think in a way we all have those times in our lives to greater or lesser extent. So Singha Manas and I were talking about earlier about relationships breaking up. I think in one sense, a relationship breaking up is like this terrible disaster and it's all awful. In another sense, it's also an invitation. It's an invitation to go deeper and really evaluate what your life is about and who you are on your own and what you want to do. There's a kind of incredible freedom actually in breaking up in a relationship as well. So, you know, it'd be good not to fill it up too quickly. Not that I've ever followed that advice myself, but there we go. I hear it's a great thing. But yeah, there's other things, you know, maybe there's a change in career or, you know, maybe in a way you kind of set up your life the way you think you want it and then you suddenly stand back and think, well, is this it? You know, you've had a certain assumptions about the way things are and where your life is going and then you kind of turn around and think, great, okay, so what's next, you know? And maybe you look around and you see your house is a little bit dusty. and a bit stagnant, and there's not much life or air going through it. And you have to think, okay, well, what next? How do I open the windows? How do I open the shutters? Maybe I need to look out the window a little bit. So, yeah, so my experience is particular to me at this stage in my life, but I think we all have those periods in our lives at different times. And I think they're potentially fruitful. I think they're potentially fruitful in the sense of a deeper transformation, even if sometimes that potential feels very boring and tedious and sometimes filled with despair. Actually, it's quite a fruitful time. There's this wonderful paper written by an order member called Arloka, where he says in it, in 1976, which is the year he got ordained, I formally committed myself to a course of action about which I had a whole jumble of ideas. None of these have really turned out to be of much use, except their gradual abandonment has provided a path of debris, offering the consolation that I have actually moved from where I started. In short, the practice of the Dharma, or my attempted practice at least, has not turned out to be remotely what I thought it might be like, I'm pleased to say. Because, in a sense, wouldn't it be terrible if life just turned out the way we expected it? Because then it would just be limited by imaginations, and often our imaginations just don't know hardly a fraction of what we're capable of. So let's not have lives that just turn out like we expect them to. Let's have a completely different life. Let's open our horizons again and again and again and again and again. And, you know, maybe part of opening our horizons is actually going back to the burning world and the great dark and tearing down the veils and not just relying on our own ideas about what metta is, about who we are, what our potential is, but actually searching in the fire, searching in the darkness. And there's actually a story that I wanted to tell you about that relates to this from the time of the Buddha. And it's a story from when the Buddha was very recently enlightened. And so, you know, you get the impression at the time he'd had this very, very overwhelming experience, complete revolution of consciousness. And he hadn't set up a Sangha at that point. So this whole idea of kind of monks and nuns and the whole way we think about Buddhism at this time, it wasn't like that at that time. It was just the Buddha walking around northern India talking to people. And the story is that there was a rich merchant's son called Yasa. And we get the impression he was maybe in his late teens, maybe his early 20s. And being a rich merchant's son, he had a big party. And in this party, apparently, he had lots of female musicians. This was the height of pleasure and decadence at the time of the Buddha, is to have musicians with no men amongst them playing music to you all night. And so he invited around his friends. He had this big party. And he had an experience which I'm sure a lot of us have had, which is that they had this big party, they all kind of went to sleep where they were, and then he woke up in the middle of the night, and what he saw was just horrible, because what he saw was all these female musicians with no men among them, dribbling and snoring. It kind of smelt, the lights were still on, but it had that kind of grimy, sticky atmosphere all around the palace. All his friends were kind of draped everywhere. And the whole thing, he just looked around and it was basically just mess and carnage. And no beauty there at all. So some of you might have had that experience. I wouldn't like to assume that kind of experience where you wake up in the morning and you think, where actually am I? And who are these people? They looked really great last night and we were having a great time, but they really don't look so good now. And of course, what Yasa does at that point is he just completely freaks. And he just runs out of the palace going, it's frightening, it's horrible, it's frightening, it's horrible. And he just like legs it basically out of the palace, out of the city and into the park. So it's going to be very, very early in the morning. Well, maybe not that early, but you know, it's more before most people have got up. He's sort of seeing the morning from the other side, if you like. And he goes into the park and just running again, sort of saying again and again, it's frightening, it's horrible. And he goes and he suddenly sees this image. He sees someone in the park who's completely still. One of the qualities of the Buddha that they talk about is he stands completely within himself. So there's no kind of looking to other people for approval or looking around him to get some sort of sense of identity. He's just still in himself. And the Buddha's very mindfully just walking up and down with his eyes slightly focused on the floor. But this incredible sense of sort of energy and presence and sort of vibrancy. And Nyasa just stops. He just stops when he sees the Buddha. And the Buddha turns to him and he looks at him with his elephant gaze. You know, the Buddha was meant to look with this gaze that completely took you in. He turned his whole being towards Nyasa. And he said, "This is not frightening. This is not horrible." And Nyasa says, "No, it's not." And then they sit down next to each other and just start talking. You know, this was before the Buddha invented all those lists. He just talked to Nyasa. He just told him the way things are. And Nyasa became, he became an enlightened being. So, yes, in a way, that was that experience of Nyasa. He also had that time when he saw this house. He saw the crowded and dusty house. He longed for the open air. He longed for freedom. He longed for a different way of being. And I think sometimes we can find ourselves in that sort of state. So finding myself in that sort of state, I've had to kind of reevaluate, well, what is metta? What does metta actually mean? And it's not enough to just say, be more loving. I think that's part of the reason I became Buddhist. It's not enough to just say, you know, just be more loving right here, now, you know, when you're in the kind of dusty, decaying house. Actually, I've had to ask myself, well, how? You know, how do I really cultivate love? And that's, again, why I became a Buddhist, is because Buddhism teaches a path. It's not just about saying to people, be more loving. It teaches you how. Where is the path? Where is the unshakable way? So I've had to go back to the beginning and in a way had to look deeply at my own experience to find out what metta really is, really sort of search for it in that darkness. And I think to do that process, what I've had to do is just go back to my own awareness, go back to awareness itself. Because whatever's going on for you, you can always practice awareness. You can always come back to your own experience and just look. And going back to sort of mindfulness, we tend to think of mindfulness. I know in a lot of modern understanding of mindfulness, particularly in secular mindfulness, is that mindfulness is bare attention of the present moment, as it's sometimes called. So you're just aware, like right now. I always find this a bit sort of anxiety provoking, actually, to be aware right now. So I think, oh, it's gone. Oh, it's gone. It's gone. Oh, no, be aware right now. Good. Now. Anyway, we're all meant to be aware right now with no judgment, which I also find quite difficult, being a high ENTJ. About those things. I'm sorry, I should really confess that. But anyway. So then you're, you know, bare attention to the present moment, no judgment. Actually, in the great thing about Buddhism is it's incredibly technical about mental states, and there's these analysis of mental states called the Abhidharma. And in the particular version of the Abhidharma that we follow in this order, that mental state corresponds to manasikara. And manasikara is when you're, it's a mental state that's happening all the time. It's an omnipresent mental event. And it means just that awareness, just being aware of what's happening right now. But mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition is more usually a translation of sati or appamada. And sati means not letting what we know slip from our minds. So it's not just about bare attention, it's about not letting what we know slip from our minds. It's a kind of recollection. Even it's sometimes called sati sampajana. And that means a kind of recollection of what we know, the significance of the present moment, if you like, not just the present moment itself. And apamada means discerning what is positive and not letting that slip from our mind, protecting our mind against things that cannot satisfy. So you discern what is positive and you don't let it slip from your mind. And that's mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition, in the Abhidharma. So, okay, so that's mindfulness. That's what I'm paying attention to in my present experience, discerning what is positive and not letting it slip from my mind. But what is it that we know? What is it that is possible, positive, and how do we not let it slip from our minds? Well, I think this is where metta comes in, actually. I think, in a way, metta is not particularly complicated in a sense. It's just a particular function of awareness, or quality even of awareness. And what I did is that when I looked in my experience, I noticed that all the time there was a seed of liberation. All the time there was a longing for my own liberation and the liberation of others. All the time there was a longing for transformation. So even if I was in the kind of real pit of this dark wasteland, there was a longing to be out of it. And it was that longing that was the seed of metta, and a longing for other people as well, for them to be out of it, for them to experience positive mental states, if you like. And in a way, that's what is positive in my experience, and it's always there. The seed of it is always there. There was a time when I was feeling quite a lot of ill will, actually, which is a deeply unpleasant mental state to be in. It's just awful. It's worse than anyone else can do to you, is to be in a state of ill will. And what I noticed, I was thinking, oh no, you know, look, I'm just like, oh, in this kind of really toxic swamp. What am I going to do with this? And actually I thought, well, I am in that, but there's also a desire not to be in that state. And it's that desire, that slight glimpse, a seed of not wanting to be in that experience, of wanting to be in connection with that person, that really is the seed of metta. In a way, that's what metta is. It's that, just that longing to transcend, that longing for transformation, that longing to be in connection both with our own experience and with the experience of others. There's a very, very beautiful sutra, Buddhist teaching from the Mahayana tradition, where it said, "Truly, a tiny sparrow emerging from the membrane of an egg, without the shell fully broken and without stepping out of the egg, utters just a sparrow's cry. Even so, Manjushri, a bodhisattva wrapped in the membrane of ignorance, without breaking the delusion of self, or stepping out of the triple world, utters the cry of a Buddha, the cry of Shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined." And I think that's what I noticed in my experience. Whatever the experience was, there was the cry of Shunyata, which means reality, which means, in a way, openness and the truth, the cry of the truth, unconditioned and unconfined. And if I could focus on that and not let that slip from my mind, the veil was torn open. So in a way, I think that's apamada, which is also a kind of function. Metta is a function of apamada. It's knowing, seeing what is positive and not letting that slip from our minds. And Bhante Sangharakshita makes the point that apamada is a process. It's a movement or activity, not a quality that one has achieved. Which basically means you're doing it all the time. It's not something you can just rest, like, I'm either a loving person or I'm not, or I'm in a state of metta or I'm not. It's something that we have to keep coming back to. We have to keep finding what's positive in our experience, hold that in our mind and dwell on that. And that's bhavana. The way the Buddha described it is, whatever you dwell on, that becomes the inclination of your mind. So if you dwell on that kind of positive urge for transcendence, that becomes the inclination of your mind. And if we focus on that, we protect our mind from anything that cannot satisfy us, or even anything that harms us. There's a lovely reading from Padmasambhava, where he says, "For the child who knows his way, everything he carries along the path is harmless. Nothing will harm him." And it's that kind of image, you know, you are whatever your experience is, but you pick up that which is harmless, which actually helps you, and you discard anything that harms you. But of course, we can go further than that, because that's the seed of metta in our experience, but we can carry it outward. We can carry out this metta. And we can carry it out in different directions, allow it to flow in different directions. So in 1968, Sangharakshita gave a series of lectures on the Noble Eightfold Path. She was originally called Vision and Transformation, but I think it's gone back to being called the Noble Eightfold Path. And in that series of lectures, Sangharakshita talks about four dimensions of awareness. And I was thinking, well, in a way, if metta is a particular quality of awareness, then we can take that metta out into those four dimensions of awareness. In a way, they're not just four dimensions of awareness, they're four dimensions of metta. And I like to think of those four dimensions of awareness as just metta radiating out in different directions, whatever we're aware of. So whatever we bring our attention to, that we can bring metta to as well. The quality of metta radiating out in all directions. So I'm just going to talk about those four areas. So the first one is metta towards the environment. So again, if metta is about just starting with awareness, well, we can start by being just aware of the world around us. And of course, the world today is so distracted by music, constant flow of music, the internet, shops, phones on all the time. I actually had a dream last night that everyone here was sitting on these rows of tables and we were all playing with our gadgets. You know, so none of us were talking to each other, which is quite a modern thing. So none of us were talking to each other. We were just on our iPhones and Macs and iPads and whatever it was. We all had different gadgets. And then these armed robbers came in. And I looked up and I was like, oh, wow, there's these armed robbers. And then, but I could kind of feel my attention just going back to my phone. and then the person next to me said, wow, there's armed robbers here and no one's even noticed. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And then they kind of left. These armed robbers got completely confused. So it's not quite the response they wanted. Anyway, so don't worry, your iPad is safe. Anyway, there we go. But I thought, well, that's what happens, isn't it? We're so kind of absorbed in our sort of own lives and our own technological equipment. And whatever it is, that our senses are just dulled. And then what happens is we start to look at the world around us just in terms of what we can get. You know, that things become to us just something that gets in our way or helps us, or we want it or we don't want it. And it's all about us. So we have this relationship with the world outside of this us that's just about us and our mental states. So if we're going to have metta towards the environment, then what we need to do is learn to look and taste and hear and smell and feel things just as they are in themselves, without putting on this layer of what does it mean for me. So just seeing things from their own side, not just in terms of whether we want them or not. And the way this is talked about, the way Sangharakshita talks about this, is seeing the universe as alive, that things are always moving and transforming. They're alive from their own side, not just in relation to us. There's a lovely little quote by Emerson where he says, "Come out of your warm, angular house, resounding with few voices, into the chill, grand, instantaneous night, with such presence as a full moon in the clouds, and you are struck with poetic wonder." And I love that image again of the house, the crowded, dusty house, and you just come out and you're struck with poetic wonder. And sometimes that happens. And the thing about poetic wonder is it's not trying to see things in relation to what I can get out of it. It's just delighting. It's just delighting in things as they are in themselves. And again, there's this wonderful passage in the Nature of Existence seminar, which if you want to read a Sangharakshita seminar, is just brilliant. It was the first one I ever read, and I've just recently done a retreat based on it. And in that, Sangharakshita talks about seeing, with the eyes of reality. So what happens when you see the world with insight? And he says, well, when you see the world with insight, you see the world as alive. Rocks and trees and rivers are in a constant process of transformation. And everything around us, even the bricks, even the windows, are in this constant process of transformation. And he even talks about, well, you know, it's not a bad thing to be an animist. So I could make my secret confession here that I actually am an animist and I do believe in fairies. And I also go and make offerings to them as well. So if you ever want to hang out with me and go and talk to some trees, I know a lot of trees. So there we go. Going back to seeing the universe as alive. And what's quite funny in the seminar is he says at one point, he says, I do find it quite hard to see plastic as alive, but I see that as my own failing. So of course when we see the universe as alive, when we see the environment as alive and constantly transforming, we want it to be free. We don't want to stand in the way of its transformation. And I think this is metta in action to the environment, is doing everything we can to get out of the way of the universe's own aliveness and not to relate to it on the basis of our own wants and what we can get out of it. And of course, you know, a lot of us grew up with a lot of emphasis on this in our education and practical steps to make some effort to protect the environment. And I think we need to make those choices in our lives to enable the environment to remain free. You know, we've inherited a big mess, basically. And young people are the people who are going to solve that mess, because we can't rely on the older generation. And I think in a way, the biggest mess, or what the mess really starts from, is the attitude that my wants come first and the environment is an object that I can either have or reject. But it's all in relation to me and what I want. So I think relating on the basis of metta is a longing in a way for the liberation of the world around us. The liberation actually primarily from human craving and the destructive nature of human craving. And how best to do that, how best to liberate the environment, I don't know. And I know that a lot of people here know more than me. I was talking to Joe and Cara, particularly, do a lot of work in this area, and anti-fracking movements and things like that. But I think what I also see is the main thing we need to do is start by seeing the world as alive and not ours to have. And on the basis of that intention, to get out of its way. And that's the fundamental basis of positive action in the environment, to see the universe as alive and to want to get out of its way. So that's metta towards the environment, but the second dimension of metta is metta towards ourselves. So again, if metta is about awareness, we can start by just being aware of ourselves. Aware of our body, whether we're standing, sitting, moving, breathing, whatever's going on for us in our physical experience, which is, you know, one of the most stable elements of our experience, because the rest of it is our mind. And as we know, our mind is changing all the time. So it's becoming aware of our feelings, pleasant, painful, neutral, bored, happy, sad, aversion, fear, anxiety, jealousy, desire, love, delight, whatever it is, just being aware of the simple feelings and the more complex emotions. And also our thoughts, as we all know when we start to meditate, what the first thing we notice is just how unruly our minds are, just going in this way and that, the play of our mind that moves in that direction and then moves in this direction. And our conditioning, it's very important to be aware of one's conditioning, and the direction of our actions that move in accordance to patterns laid down previously, particularly in early life. And to look at our whole conditioning, you know, our gender conditioning, our age conditioning, our family conditioning, our national conditioning, our cultural conditioning, our educational conditioning, all those things that determine the patterns by which we act. So when we're really aware of these things, when we're aware of our body, our feelings, our thoughts, our conditioning, well, what do we see? Well, we start to see that we also are alive. We also are in a constant process of transformation. And within that is a longing for positive transformation, a longing to connect with our higher potential. And I think this is self-metta. It comes out in the phrase in the Metta Bhavana, may I progress. And sometimes, just as it is with the environment, I think sometimes that means getting out of our own way and protecting ourselves from things that don't satisfy. And again, looking in our experience for that longing to grow, for that longing to develop, that cry of shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined. And I was thinking about this because I've come across quite a sort of strange idea about self-metta. And the strange idea about self-metta that I've encountered is that you have to deserve it in some way, that you have to be good, or you have to go through your merits and rejoice in your merits, which I'm sure you all have many merits. But in a way, that's kind of not the point, because sometimes it's quite difficult to really be in contact with those merits. And you don't have to be good to love yourself. You don't have to be positive or happy or really bubbly on that occasion. And self-metta doesn't have to feel particularly lovely or bubbly or like you want to jump up and down or give yourself a big hug or something. And I've got a slight aversion to hugs, so I'm working on it. Actually, I think what self-metta is finding that intention to grow whatever our state is. It's looking, it's finding that longing for transformation, whatever state we're in. It's recognizing that we're growing vibrant human beings with great potential, with limitless potential, and actually cultivating a love based on that. May I grow, may I develop. And actually can feel quite serious. Sometimes it can feel bright and positive, and sometimes it can feel quite serious. But I think in a way that is self-metta. It's finding the longing for freedom in a real awareness of ourselves, in our body, our feelings, our thoughts and our conditions, or conditioning, and really finding that that longing for transformation. And I think if we've got that real longing for transformation in our own lives, that expresses itself in a dedication to spiritual practice. So I think self-metta, we know if we've got self-metta because we start to want to enter onto that kind of urgent quest to grow and do everything necessary to contribute to our own development. And I think that's self-metta. When I really think, oh yeah, someone's really got self-metta, what I see is that they see themselves as alive and they want to enable their own growth. And how we enable our own growth changes. But I think sometimes we have to be prepared to take risks. We have to be prepared to take risks for our own growth. So I know that when I was thinking about moving to Tiruvannamalai, I had to think about, I was thinking, well, how do I make that decision? How do I make a decision to just leave Sheffield, which is a wonderful place and has a very great and lovely sangha? You know, how do I make a decision to leave somewhere I'm actually quite happy and move somewhere else? And I decided it kind of came down to three things. One of them was my own personal happiness. So I don't think it's going to help anyone if you don't just get enough pleasure in your life. So, you know, I had to really think about, would I get enough pleasure living in rural mid Wales, having been brought up in South London? So I had to think about that. Would I be happy? And I actually decided that I would be, because I'm basically happy if I can practice the Dharma and I've got friends. So I've got friends, I can practice the Dharma, I'm pretty much all right. So I thought about my own happiness, and then I also thought about, well, what would contribute to my spiritual development? Because in a way, I think that's a very important consideration when we're taking in our own lifestyle choices. How would it contribute to my own growth? And the other thing that I had to think about was how it would contribute to the growth of others, how particularly, you know, I'm an order member, so what I do impacts on the Tree Ratna Buddhist order itself. So I had to think, well, what's the best thing for the order? And for that, I asked Sangharakshita. And he said, well, it's a pity you can't be in both places at once. So I asked my preceptor. But I was very pleased to get Bhante's blessing. Yeah, so I think it's very important to take that into consideration. Well, what's going to contribute to our own spiritual development? And maybe the answer isn't simple. Maybe you do need to consult your friends on that point. So the third area is metta towards others. And of course, this is the area we're most familiar about when we're talking about metta. And again, it comes back to awareness, because we tend to regard other people as objects. We divide other people into people we like, people we're slightly indifferent to, and people we don't like. And of course, that's what the stages of the metta bhavana are based on. And so we see other people just in terms of our own responses, likes or dislikes. So, which is seeing people on the basis of our own subjective projection, basically, and what we think they are. But, of course, people exist from their own side. They're alive themselves with their own thoughts and feelings. Thoughts and feelings that are very, very similar to our own, but are also a bit different. So, if you were in Sheffield, when I was in Sheffield, you'll know what I'm about to say. Which is the great quote that you've always got to quote if you give a talk on metta, which is, love is no mere flabby sentiment, but the vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings. So the quote from Sangharakshita from the Ten Pillars. So it's a vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings, which means you have to sort of step out of your own responses and actually look at someone. We have to look at people from their own side. And then what we do is we start to see them as alive, as growing, as developing. Or to quote a Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz, standing in the glow of ripeness. And I think that's what we have to do if we're going to cultivate metta for others, is actually just to be aware of them, be aware that they exist from their own side. And as we see that they exist from their own side, we see them as alive. And as we see people as alive, as growing, as developing, then we have a longing for their growth and we have a desire to get out of their way so that they can grow. And it relates very much to a vision that the Buddha had after his enlightenment. Apparently, the Buddha's enlightenment wasn't just one idea, you know, that suddenly flashed into his consciousness and that was it. It actually took a number of weeks for it to unfold in different directions. So he sat in meditation for a number of weeks, allowing his enlightenment experience to unfold in his consciousness. And what he saw was that he saw that all beings are like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. And he saw that some people were nearer than light. Some people were, a little bit stuck at that time. But he saw that all people were fundamentally growing. And it said that he shook with a kind of sympathy for living beings, these growing, developing living beings, longing for the light. And when the Buddha saw that vision, something extraordinary happened. So you might not think this is extraordinary, but you've got to put it in perspective. When the Buddha saw that all beings were like lotuses growing into the light, he got up and he walked. And that was quite actually unusual at the time in India, because a lot of the kind of religious teachers, they would realize something and then they would wait for teachers to come to for disciples to come to them. So it was actually Dr. Ambedkar who made this point, that when the Buddha had that vision of all beings' potential, of all beings in fundamentally growing towards the light, he got up and he walked. And he walked a long way, actually. He walked from Bodh Gaya to Sarnath to find his old friends, his old companions in the spiritual life, and to tell them what he had seen, to help them to grow into the light. So he walked a long way. I don't really know how many miles that is, but it took 4 hours in a taxi. It was a long way. And he walked that walk in May, so it was very, very hot. Anyway, so he did that, and he did that out of gratitude to his friends. So I think in a way, sometimes we're in the same position. When we see the potential of others, when we see the potential of our friends, we have to walk. We have to walk out of our comfortable world, out of our angular, dusty house, and into the stormy night. And we have to do that to give people the gift of the Dharma. And so some of us, I say the stormy night because it's really tempting not to go to the Buddhist centre in winter, you know, because it's kind of wet and a bit cold, and you could be staying at home reading a book, and could be staying reading at home a book, and it would be really good for my spiritual development. But actually, it's out of gratitude that we walk. It's out of gratitude to our friends. And it can start by just simple things like helping out at the Buddhist Center, just being there at the Buddhist Center and being friendly to people, particularly to other young people who might feel a bit nervous and you might be able to connect with. And some of us will walk out even further than that and take the Dharma out further than that. I know a lot of you are involved in outreach classes. And maybe there's further to go into unknown areas, areas that even I haven't thought of yet, none of us have thought of yet. And it's important that we do that, because otherwise the Dharma will die out. And if we believe that the Dharma has helped us to grow, out of gratitude to the Dharma and to our friends, in a way we have an obligation or a duty, and it's not a very popular word, but to make it available to others, out of gratitude to give what we have been given. Because, of course, what we see when we see the world is there is so much suffering, and largely it's to do with people's own mental states and not seeing their potential. Living in that burning world and not being able to see a way out. And we can give them something. We can give them something that will help show them the way out. And maybe what we can give them is even just a bit of friendliness, even a bit of human connection. I don't think we can underestimate what it gives someone just to be able to look at them. Because a lot of people have gone through most of their lives without anyone taking them seriously. So I'm talking about my own experience there, and arriving at the Buddhist Center at 17, and people looked at me and they talked to me and they took me seriously. And that had such a profound effect on me, because no one had taken me seriously before. And we used to stay up late into the night talking about philosophy and all sorts of things. And it's probably complete garbage, but and I probably wasn't making any sense. But it was the fact that they were there, they looked at me, they took me seriously, that just changed my whole life. Mm-hmm. So we could do that for other people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it is very interesting being at Adisthana. I was here at the opening and I got this very, very strong sense, this is our retreat centre. It's our retreat centre. Not, I know a lot of you have volunteered here. I volunteered here. I painted the shrine room. I'm quite proud of it, you know. I'm not great at painting. Anyway, so a lot of us volunteered here. We worked here, but even if you didn't, it's still yours. You know, it's very much an atmosphere at Adisthana that it's our retreat centre. And what I realized at the opening, that I know some of you were there, was this incredible positive confidence that Buddhism is here to stay, and that the Tree Ratna Buddhist order is here to stay, even when Bhante dies. And that we have a contribution to make for the future, that this place is being set up for the future. And I don't think it's too arrogant to say, actually, that we are the future. Well, at least we can choose to be the future. It's up to us. In a way, Buddhism, the Buddhist tradition is in our hands. It's in our hands for the future. So we can do with that what we like. But if you really feel it's benefited you, then you can make it available to others. And in fact, this is what Yasa did. So the second part of the story about Yasa is that after he became an enlightened being, his friends noticed. So his friends went around to see him, and then suddenly there he was, this very pleasure-seeking guy. He used to wear gold slippers, apparently. Obviously the fashion at the time, possibly still is. So there was this guy, you know, so you get this sense he was kind of quite trendy, really into parties, and then they went round to see him, and he had a shaved head and was wearing robes and no shoes at all. And they were thinking, well, what's going on? Well, it must be something quite special. It must be quite special if Yasa's got involved. So they became interested, and then they started to talk to him about it, and then he took them to the Buddha, and then they all got enlightened too, which is lovely. So they were kind of this community of mates who all became enlightened beings. And then it's very interesting, because what the Buddha then says is he says, well, actually, I'll read it to you, actually. It's a very famous quote, this. He says, I am free from all shackles, whether human or divine. You too are free from all shackles, whether human or divine. Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare and happiness of gods and men. Teach the Dharma that is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end, with the meaning and the letter. Explain a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the Dharma. So I think that's meta for others in a sense. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the Dharma. So the last dimension of metta is metta towards reality itself. And in a way, this isn't different from the other dimensions of metta, because if we're aware of our environment, ourselves and others, we are aware of reality itself. Because reality itself, of course, is not some sort of separate realm. It's here, it's now. It's a way of seeing things. It's seeing the world with new eyes, and seeing into reality right here and now, directly and non-conceptually. But, you know, again, it's another thing. It's a sort of peculiar thing to just be aware of reality. Like, right, okay, be aware now. It's here, now. No, it's there. Oh, no, it's here. You can't just be aware of reality right now unless you're having a kind of vision into the way things are, because what you end up doing is you end up just thinking about reality, which is a different thing. And of course it's useful, but thinking about reality is not the same as seeing reality. It's ideas about reality rather than reality itself. So if we're going to actually see reality itself, we have to be aware of the reality expressing itself through an object of awareness. It's a bit of a complicated sentence, I now realise. But it's a bit like, well, we have to look deeply at things. We have to look deeply at things, well, our environment, ourselves and others, and see the reality which they're expressing. Look beyond the object, the reality behind. What is the reality it's expressing? And the most useful way in the Buddhist tradition to do this is to look at the figure of the Buddha himself. Because in a way you could see the Buddha as reality embodied in a human being, in a human life. And so to look at the life of the Buddha is to really understand, you get a flavour of how reality expresses itself. So all the stories about the Buddha express the behaviour of someone who has seen reality, who's seen into reality. And if we reflect on the stories of the Buddha, we get a flavour of that reality. And then what happens is the Buddha becomes alive. He becomes beautiful. And we see enlightenment not as just some sort of static state, not just an idea or a set of ideas about reality, but enlightenment as irreversibly creative, as Sangharakshita calls it. So how are we going to have metta towards that? It's quite a kind of strange thing, but I think what happens is when we see, when we recognise that in this burning and restless world, there is something that is truly of value, truly positive and truly satisfying. We sort of love reality for itself. We sort of love the potential irreversible creativity that exists within reality, that whenever conditions are ripe, a Buddha will arise, that it's possible. I think that's what we love when we see reality. We love the fact that enlightenment is possible. And we love reality for its own sake, just because it's beautiful. There's so many beautiful and tender moments in the life of the Buddha. Tender moments, a bit like that story with Yasa, just arriving in a state and the Buddha saying, it's not frightening, it's not horrible. Just those little tender moments. Because, of course, what the Buddha's seeing is he's seeing there's a possibility of freedom in every moment, no matter what your state you're in. You know, here's Yasa, a bit of a mess, actually. And I really sympathise with that because I feel like I was a bit of a mess when I was 17. Probably still am in some ways, but I was a real mess when I was 17. And, you know, just to have that kind of solid presence, this is not frightening, this is not horrible. You know, for me, that was the men's community in South London. This is not frightening, this is not horrible. It's possible to grow, it's possible to transform, it's possible even to be liberated. And it doesn't matter what sex you are or age you are or cultural background you're from or educational standards that you reached or anything like that, it's possible. So I think love of reality means seeing that possibility of freedom in every moment, seeing the possibility for connection, that desire to connect with others and to be able to connect with others. And we've all had those moments where you've been entrenched in this kind of weird dynamic with someone and you can't quite see your way out. And then suddenly you just think, I just want to drop all that. I just want to drop all that and connect with this person. And you do. And that's a real magic. There's a real miracle in that, being able to just connect with someone. Maybe here on the weekend, maybe you just sat down next to someone you don't know. And you have that moment where all that kind of projections, all the subjective stuff that you get into just drops. And there's just two human beings talking to each other. And that is a beautiful, beautiful thing. So we love reality because it's beautiful. So in the Survey of Buddhism, Sangharakshita says, not for one's own sake, nor even for the sake of others should one seek to attain the divine, but simply and solely for its own irresistible sake. Okay, so there's, I'll just sort of wrap up now, but I've noticed recently there's a lot of talk about insight, which I think is great. I think people are becoming really interested in the potentiality of human consciousness. But I've noticed something, which I'm not going to scientifically back, because I haven't, you know, made lists or anything, but I've noticed something about Sangharakshita's teaching, which is whenever he talks about insight, whenever he talks about seeing the nature of reality or seeing through fixed separate selfhood, he talks about the metta-bhavana in the next paragraph. Always. Which is unscientifically fact. You're probably going to come up, actually, Vajratara, he doesn't. Look, I've just found a book and he doesn't. you know, but anyway, that's what I've noticed, is that that he always talks about the metta bhavana as the main insight practice. Well, why is that? I think it's because when metta means that we have to learn to look at the world in a different way. And rather than relating to the world on the basis of me and my grasping and my subjective projections, my limited self-view, instead of seeing the world in terms of the cages of our own sort of personality, if you like, we see what lies beyond. And we're aware of the environment, we're aware of ourselves, we're aware of others, we're aware even of reality as alive, impermanent, in a constant process of transformation, a constant process of coming into being. And when we see the world like that, we do whatever we can to aid positive transformation, or at least to get out of the way. And that's metta. It's seeing the world with new eyes. And it's a relief, because we can all do that. Wherever we're starting from, we can all start just now by practicing awareness, by seeing the universe as alive, seeing beings as alive, seeing reality as alive, and just learn to be aware of that aliveness, aware of the potential for growth, aware for the potential for connection, and keeping that in mind. That's all we have to do, is just keep that in mind, let that grow, not letting that potential slip from our mind. And that's the small tear that lets in the light. A bit like Pip coming out into Miss Havisham's house, tearing down the curtains, throwing open the shutters, and letting in the light and the trees and the air. And that's, in a way, the metta bhavana, and that's metta practice. And that's how we practice metta, not just for ourselves, of course, but for everyone and everything.